welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 4th. Happy July 4th, everyone, and happy Independence Day. We'll start today's reading with a look at the weather. Today is supposed to be sunny with a high of 89, a low of 68 in Cedar Rapids. And Iowa City will have a high of 90, a low of 69. Monday's weather looks to be a high of 90 with a low of 71 in Cedar Rapids, high of 91, low of 72 in Iowa City. Tuesday and Wednesday, we get some rain with a high of 89, low of 67, and a high of 80, low of 64 in Cedar Rapids. Tuesday, Iowa City gets a high of 90, low of 68, with a high of 81, low of 65 on Wednesday for Iowa City. So weather's not too bad for these next few days, but it'll get a little rainy in the end, which we need, so it's not a bad thing. Let's take a look at the front page stories. Development explosion underway in southwest Cedar Rapids. Restaurants missing key ingredient, workers. An awe-inspiring work launches fireworks show. We'll start with the development story. Officials estimate $1 billion of investment there in 5 years. It began in the Cedar Rapids City Manager's Conference Room. The U.S. Department of Justice regulators asked Collins Aerospace in October of 2019 to divest itself of its Global Positioning Systems Unit. The impending ownership change had a significant impact on Cedar Rapids, where hundreds were employed in the operation. The move came as part of the merger between Raytheon Company and Collins Aerospace, owner United Technologies Corporation. Not long after the merger was set in motion, Bay Systems, an international aerospace and defense company based in the United Kingdom, shared intentions to establish a presence in Cedar Rapids as the new owner of the GPS unit. City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said the city team called the company to establish a relationship and met in that room, where they learned the company was looking across the nation for a place to locate a new facility. The spread of COVID-19 turned into a season of uncertainty for the city staff as they worked remotely. Economic Development Manager Jasmine Alameyad said they chipped away that quote-unquote bizarre summer on pandemic projects with the prospect of Bay Systems facility coming to fruition, here motivating the team to press on. In July, the deal became reality. The Cedar Rapids City Council approved a development agreement for a 200,000-square-foot classified defense aerospace facility worth over $170 million that would locate 650 jobs in the city. The multinational business had options to locate in communities across the nation, and Cedar Rapids hadn't even offered the largest incentive package, Alameyad said. So what sold the company on Cedar Rapids? Quote, it was the location ultimately that sold them. That southwest quadrant of Cedar Rapids because it is easy to get to, end quote, Alameyad said. Company officials looked at layered heat maps showing where their workers lived. For Coralville employees and for workers on Cedar Rapids North end, access to Interstate 380, quote-unquote, it's a game changer, Alameyad said. Bay Systems is far from the only company taking notice of what Cedar Rapids has to offer, particularly east and west of I-380, as well as along the south of Highway 30. Ease of transportation access through the Eastern Iowa Airport and surrounding highways, as well as the availability of land primed for development, is fueling a boom of activity in the city's southwest quadrant. Given the area's growth potential, companies are shifting or expanding their footprints to this part of the city. What city officials say is the result of years of planning on their end and a dream brought to life by a private sector. City officials estimate that over the last 5 years, there has been an overall investment of $1 billion. Completed or underway in the area, including both privately led projects and nearly $714 million across 30 developments, the city has awarded incentives. Quote, this area sort of has been waiting to explode, and now that is occurring, And we're just seeing the benefits of years of really these properties sitting there waiting to be developed in different ways. And now it's kind of all coming together in a very, very positive way, end quote, Pomerantz said. Quote, but is really the result of planning. And now we're seeing the reality of that planning, end quote. To City Council Member Ann Poe, chairwoman of the council's development committee, that $1 billion figure means, quote, an explosion of economic development for our community. And those are dollars that are reinvested, all that payroll that is reinvested back into our community. That is, or to me, continues to keep our economy in Cedar Rapids growing strong, end quote. That investment across the city incentivizes projects has resulted in retention of 1,884 jobs and created 892, according to data provided by the city. Quote, I would continue to hope that more of the many thousands of acres that are intended for this type of development, more of that develops and brings high quality jobs to our community, end quote, said Councilmember Scott Overland, chairman of the council's Finance and Administrative Services Committee. Indeed, this growth did not happen by accident, said Community Development Director Jennifer Pratt. Southwest Cedar Rapids was identified in the city's Envision CR Future Land Use Plan as a growth area. The plan specifically calls for, quote, dedicating land for industrial projects and establishing a network of streets for emerging neighborhoods in this region. When developers came in looking for different places, they loved seeing the fact that we're shining a spotlight on that area because they know, number one, the infrastructure is there, which again, we've made lots of investments out in that area for water and sewer. We've made lots of investments in roadways, and we continue to do that, end quote, Pratt said. Quote, so having it identified as a growth area is a huge pull, end quote. This corridor has seen infrastructure improvements in recent years, with the Iowa Department of Transportation approaching completion of its four-lane expansion of Highway 30. And in 2018, the opening of a four-lane divided highway, 100, connecting the northeast and southwest quadrants of Cedar Rapids. Plus, work remains underway in expanding I-380 to 6 lanes in the area in an effort to ease the flow of traffic for commuters who rely on the road and attract new development with the improvements on both ends of the corridor. The city also works closely with the Iowa DOT to plan for traffic impacts of new projects and make road improvements accordingly, LMAO said. Cedar Rapids is in the process of drafting an overall traffic model to better brace for the system-wide impacts of rapid development in the southwest quadrant. Already, though, City Economic Development Analyst Caleb Mason said roads have been installed and converted from gravel, and the city has extended water and sewer so companies have those utilities available. Quote, we know there will be significant infrastructure improvements made in order to accommodate the growth and development, end quote, Pomerantz said. Councilmember Scott Olson, a real estate broker, has been in the business for nearly 3 decades. But in his experience, he said the development boom in the Southwest Quadrant to this scale is unprecedented. Quote, I've never seen anything like what is happening in the Southwest Quadrant, around the airport specifically, end quote, he said. Olson attributed the uptick to the amenities in this area of town offers, including a high amount of shovel-ready land. The land availability and readiness for development now is a sharp contrast from many years ago, end quote, he said. Also, every piece of land around the Eastern Iowa Airport has been optioned or is under contract by developers, Olson said, and they're all doing it in anticipation of growth in the distribution industry. Cedar Rapids just last week celebrated the opening of the UPS, Inc., a new 53,800-square-foot cargo facility, an $18 million project that is expected to hire 100 employees. With that facility opening, officials are eyeing the potential for Eastern Iowa Airport to become a main cargo airport for the state. Airport Director Marty Lenz said about half of all of Iowa's air cargo traffic now comes through it, up from what used to be only 35% to 40% of the state total. Following that projected uptick in transportation and logistics-oriented companies seeking to expand their footprint, Cedar Rapids has approved tax incentives for a $108.6 million or 479,000 square foot FedEx Ground Packaging Systems Incorporated warehouse and distribution center on a new road in the Southwest Quadrant. A development agreement remains in the works for the project, which would create 434 mostly part-time jobs. It would support FedEx's St. Paul, Minnesota hub while expanding its local ground service network. Quote, when we look at development trends, not just in Cedar Rapids, but really across the state and country, warehousing and distribution are becoming more and more important. And these are facilities that cities and other governments are seeking because of their impact from an economic perspective, as well as from an employment perspective, end quote, Pamarin said. For several companies that have long been located in Cedar Rapids, Mason said, the future growth options available on the sprawling land of Southwest Quadrant are drawing some to relocate there. Rexco Equipment, a construction equipment supplier located on Blair's Ferry Road Northeast, is one such company that is making the move to the Southwest Quadrant and away from a commercial corridor where there are more site constraints, Mason said. Other companies that have similarly relocated there include Little Drug Store Products, Road Machinery, and Supply and Future Line. The city also in recent years has seen an expansion of large industrial users that already had a footprint in Cedar Rapids, such as JRS Pharma, General Mills, International Flavors and Fragrance, Diamond V Mills, and BioSpringer. Quote, some of that is through physical improvements, end quote, Mason said, of those expansions, end quote. Quote, other times it's modernization, their facilities with equipment. So we don't necessarily always see a tax base, but it's a significant investment to increase their capacity and operations. And there's usually job creation components with those, end quote. And new companies are increasingly attracted to look at Cedar Rapids for its two certified sites, Big Cedar Industrial Park and the Air and Land Super Park, which collectively offer 1,472 acres of shovel-ready space. City staff are always seeing an influx, quote unquote, of requests for information coming through from the state, which markets the sites, Mason said. A state-certified site offers relevant data and documentation about the spot, which has site characteristics and information about utilities, so companies don't have to do pre-development work. Locating on one of these sites carries a lower risk to the company. Quote, we're sort of trying to run a gamut of attracting, aiding existing industries with expansion, and even attracting more smaller companies, end quote, Mason said. Supporting these new developments and job creation with housing is another layer, end quote, Mason said. Among the city's estimated $1 billion sum of recent investments in the Southwest Quadrant are some affordable housing projects, as well as the phase $64 million mixed-use American Prairie development by APD LLC, which will be among the largest city residential projects, bringing about 400 residential units online. As the new commercial and industrial developments create new jobs, Oberland said the housing projects generated from those investments will further turn Cedar Rapids' economic wheel. Quote, it spins off a lot of other good things, end quote, Oberland said. This is hardly the beginning of Cedar Rapids' efforts to expand its tax base, Poe said. With more developments springing up in the Southwest Quadrant, Poe said she hoped the city could work with developers to bring more services to the area, such as a grocery store or an instant care facility. But time will tell what other types of businesses are lured into the quadrant as these projects come online. But as employers are actually filling those buildings, it'll start to become a place where retailers are going to want to go because they want to capture that consumer base that's there. End quote, Alameo said. The mix of residential, commercial, and industrial is generating the growth of this part of town, Pamarin said, and it's all been a vision years in the making. Quote, a number of these properties had been out there undeveloped for a long period of time, end quote, Pameron said. Quote, and now, based on all the efforts that's been put in, it's all coming together into this reality, this really positive growth and development for this community, and in particular, this area. Quote, this area sort of has been waiting to explode, and now that is occurring. And we're just seeing the benefits of years of really those properties sitting there waiting to be developed in different ways. And now it's kind of all coming together in a very, very positive way. End quote. Our next story, restaurants missing key ingredient workers. Survey, over a third of Iowa restaurants close at least a day more than usual. Gazette Lee, Des Moines Bureau, and Barb Eccles, Quad City Times, quote-unquote, we're hiring signs, have become as common at Iowa restaurants as pulled pork sandwiches. 9 out of 10 Iowa restaurants are actively seeking more staff, and more than half are operating at least 20% below normal staffing levels, according to the latest survey data from the Iowa Restaurant Association. That staffing shortage is hindering the post-pandemic recovery of Iowa restaurants, which were among the businesses hit hardest by COVID-19. Closures and restrictions, according to the trade association's leader. Quote, it's horrible. We're having the hardest time finding people, end quote, said Jessica Dunker, president and chief executive officer of the Iowa Restaurant Association. Restaurants of all types, from family to fast food, are feeling the pinch. A drive-through any Iowa City's business district provides visual confirmation, with many restaurants broadcasting their need for more workers when signs usually reserved for touting that daily special. Restaurant employment is rebounding from the pandemic, but the state's most recent, quote, accommodation and food service, end quote, employment numbers remain nearly 14% below pre-pandemic levels, according to state workforce development figures. Dunker said a convergence of issues has led to staffing shortages across the industry, which came out of the pandemic reeling. Iowa restaurants lost nearly $1.5 billion due to mitigation strategies like business closures and restrictions, an analysis by the association shows. During the pandemic, many restaurant workers, especially those with skills that translate to other professions, left the industry, and probably for good, Dunker fears. And she said many of the industry part-time workers are women, many of whom have decided to stay home in part because of the high cost of childcare. Other factors include restaurants' high share of teenage workers and lack of teenagers willing to work, and restaurants' typical summer expansion with outdoor seating, Dunker said. Quote, that is a recipe for difficulty, so we are really struggling to find workers, end quote, she said. Iowa State University economist Dave Swenson said he disagrees that restaurants' hiring struggles are attributable to labor force unwilling to work. Numbers don't show, for instance, that unemployment is higher for teens now than before the pandemic. For reasons that may not be fully understood for many months to come, however, Iowa's labor force participation loss is double that of the rest of the country. Quote, we are atypical from the nation, end quote, Swenson said. Quote, I take great issue, however, with employers who impugn the Iowa workforce, end quote, especially with so many Iowans working more than one job. While a clear understanding of the forces at work will come with time and data, no anecdotes in study of impacted demographics has revealed some explanation for the staffing shortages. He said, one of the hardest hit employment demographics has been the under 24 age group, and those workers present a large number of the dining and drinking industry staff. Many of them had not worked long enough to qualify for unemployment benefits when the pandemic hit, Swenson said, so they found work elsewhere when restaurants were forced to close. Quote, unemployment was very high in that demographic, Swenson said. Quote, they moved back home and or found other jobs. The restaurants likely just lost those workers because they moved on, end quote. Another big loss in the Iowa has been among the 45 to 54 range age group. No one is sure why so many in that age group dropped out, but childcare costs are not likely a factor, he said. Quote, "We don't have an explanation," Swenson said. "It doesn't make sense. They're not the mothers, though." Other demographic with the labor force decline was the over 60 set, he said. Many left their jobs for health reasons or for fear of health impacts during the pandemic, and they took early retirement. Regardless of the age group, the result is the same, he said. Quote, "Restaurants are going to have to work extra hard to recruit people back into food service," end quote. Some already have. Quote, "We don't have a staffing problem," end quote, said Dan Bush, co-owner of Armored Gardens in Davenport and Analog Arcade Bars in Davenport and Moline, Illinois. Quote, "We did for a minute," end quote. Quote, "The $9 and $10 an hour wages, those days just don't exist anymore. Others are fighting that. Some are closing instead, which doesn't make sense because they are then making no money," end quote, he said. While job applications aren't coming in like they used to, Bush said, raising wages resolves short-term staffing concerns. Quote, "Our retention is good," end quote, he said. Quote, "We're not getting a lot of apps, but we're not losing people either," end quote. Other restaurateurs are finding it necessary to make other concessions, Dunker said. According to the Iowa Restaurant Association survey of its members, more than half are not operating at full capacity. More than a third are closed for one or more days per week, more than usual. And a fifth have dropped breakfast or lunch service. Quote, "And it's got nothing to do with COVID. It's because they don't have the employees," end quote, Dunker said. Quote, "They just don't have them," end quote. The shortage also is placing a stress on the staff members they have remained. According to the association's survey, nearly 9 out of 10 restaurants say existing staff are working more hours and performing more duties, and roughly a fifth of restaurants are rotating staff among multiple locations. Dunker said boosted unemployment benefits created to help workers who were hurt fiscally by the pandemic were contributing to restaurant staffing issues. Governor Kim Reynolds ended Iowa's participation in the federally boosted benefits program effective June 12th. The Indeed Hiring Lab and team of economists who use Indeed job board data to study the labor market found the number of Iowa job seekers briefly increased after Reynolds announced the move in April, but that job searches decreased after the federal benefit ended and is now below the late April baseline. Advocates for higher workers' wages are often critical of restaurant worker wages. The median hourly for food preparation and service-related jobs in Iowa was $11.11 in May of 2020. The most recent point the data is available, according to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics data. In order to attract staffing during this shortage, many restaurants are boosting base wages, and some are offering incentives, such as signing bonuses. Quote, "They're willing to pay it because the market demands it," end quote, Dunker said. Quote, "We really feel like wages have been driven up and the market's done that, and that's fine," end quote. Iowa's overall unemployment rate was 3.9% in May, down more than half the 8.3% it was 1 year earlier during the pandemic, according to the state's workforce development data. Zachary DuPont of Mason City Globe Gazette contributed to this report. Our next story, awe-inspiring work launches fireworks show. Freedom Festival display has its largest fireworks ever. The Gazette Cedar Rapids, Paul Myers, has been operating the Freedom Festival fireworks display for 20 years, but he says he still finds the process nerve-wracking. Before thousands of fireworks can light up the sky at night, each of the pyrotechnics must be painstakingly placed. Quote, "I get very detail-oriented. I get very stressed," end quote, said Myers, lead operator for J&M Displays of Yarmouth. Quote, "I'm blessed to have a great crew, though, and they know what I want, they know what I anticipate, and I don't have to give a lot of instruction," end quote. The setup for the display takes about 20 hours of work, starting at 6 p.m. July 3rd, to when the fireworks are set off at dusk July 4th. For tonight's show, a crew of 10 people worked to assemble the fireworks Saturday night on First Avenue Bridge in downtown Cedar Rapids. After the perimeter of the site was set and secured, crews begin and get to work, unloading trucks full of tubes and begin the process of laying them out. Quote, "For every break in the sky, there's a tube in the ground," end quote, Meyer said. Quote, there's literally thousands of tubes on the ground that we have to get in to a certain order, end quote. The crew works late into the night and returns on the holiday to finish setup by morning so testing can take place before the show. The timing of the firework display is completely controlled by computer. Quote, for everything you see break in the sky, there's a wire attached to the ground that tells it when to fire, end quote, he said. Though he's been on the job for 2 decades, Myers said the stakes of putting together the show each year can be rattling. Make sure the show goes off without a hitch is a big responsibility. Carol Shepherd, executive director of Freedom Festival, said that planning for the next year's show already begins July 5th. The first step in the process is choosing the musical selections for the show, as all of the fireworks are choreographed to detonate one time with the music. The Freedom Fest fireworks show was canceled last year amid the pandemic, and due to continuing uncertainty this year, she and her team knew the fireworks show would be able to take place downtown only 10 weeks ahead of the event, condensing what typically would be a year's worth of planning into a few months. Quote, a lot of us worked our tails off, end quote, Shepherd said. Despite the short turnaround time, this year's show will feature the largest fireworks scene at Freedom Fest to date. The launch site has been moved back slightly, allowing for operators to shoot off larger fireworks shells without endangering the crowd. The show will feature 6,766 individual shells. Quote, they can put a lot more pyrotechnic material in a 5-inch shell than they can in a 3-inch shell, end quote, Myers said. Quote, so people are going to see more pattern shells like heart stars, smiley faces, and Saturns, end quote. Shepherd is expecting even larger crowds at the Freedom Festival display tonight than in previous years. The Cedar Boat Club display was canceled this year, and fireworks in Marion will take place on Labor Day. The, quote, interest has been very high, appreciating that a lot of other communities also planning in the pandemic, some have chosen not to move forward with their display, end quote, Shepherd said. The fireworks will take place at dusk tonight. Prime viewing spots are from the 2nd Avenue Bridge and the McGrath Amphitheater. Entry is free with the Freedom Festival button, but kids 8 and under don't need a button to enter. This year is Shepherd's first as executive director of Freedom Festival. For the first time, she watched the fireworks being set up for Friday evening. Quote, it's truly awe-inspiring, end quote, she said. Quote, pretty unbelievable, end quote. Our next story out of Florida, demolition preparations begin for Florida condo. Search suspended ahead of storm. Rescuers suspended their search for the living and the dead in the rubble of a collapsed South Florida condo building Saturday to allow crews to start preparing the unstable remainder of the structure for demolition ahead of a tropical storm. The search and rescue mission was halted in the afternoon as workers began the precarious business of boring holes to hold explosives in the concrete of the still standing portion of the Chaplain Tower's South Tower in Surfside, Miami-Dade. Assistant Chief and Fire Chief Rade Jadula told relatives awaiting word on missing loved ones. In the closed-door briefing, Jadula said the suspension was a necessary safety measure because the drilling could cause the structure to fall and fail. If that were to happen, he said, it's just going to collapse without warning, end quote. But in video that one of the relatives live-streamed on social media, one of them was heard calling it, quote, devastating, end quote, that the search was on pause. She asked whether rescuers could at least work the perimeter of the site so as not, quote, to stop the operation for so many painful hours, end quote. Also Saturday, the confirmed death toll from the partial collapse of the 12-story building rose to 24 with the discovery of 2 more bodies. There were 121 people still unaccounted for. Concerns have been mounting over the past week that the damaged structure was a risk of failure, endangering the crews below. The search in adjacent areas of the collapsed site was curtailed and shifts detected by monitors early Thursday prompted a 15-hour suspension of the entire effort until engineers determined it was safe to resume. The building won't come down until Monday at the earliest, according to Jadula. That estimate was based on how many holes the demolition team need to drill, he said, adding that the process has to move slowly to prevent a premature collapse. with Tropical Storm Elsa looming in the Caribbean and forecast to move toward the state in the coming days, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said demolishing the, quote, tottering, end quote, and, quote, structurally unsound, end quote, structure is the prudent thing to do. Quote, the fear was that Elsa may take the building down for us and take it down in the wrong direction, end quote, Surfside Mayor Charles Burkett said. Once the structure is demolished, the remnants will be removed immediately with the intent of giving rescuers access for the first time to parts of the garage area that were focused of interest, DeDula said. That could give a clearer picture of voids that may exist in the rubble. No one has been rescued alive since the first hours after the June 24th collapse. Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava said officials would resume the search and rescue on any sections of the pile that are, quote, safe to access as soon as we are cleared, end quote. Some families had asked to be able to return to the building to retrieve personal belongings, but they would not be allowed to do so. And that'll bring us to the midpoint of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 4th. I'm your reader, Glorietta Foley, and you are listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service. We'll continue today's reading by looking at one item out of the opinion section before we move over to our obituaries. So we'll read the community letters, starting with our first one here. A month ago, we signed up for 34 farm acres into the Conservation Reserve Program pending this October 1st. Well, that was withdrawn from Farm Service Agency earlier in the month and upgraded. So I went to the local FSA office and signed anew the 34 acres with the FSA. Now the pending contract proposal offers an additional $54 per acre. Over a 15-year period, that is $27,540 more. Providing income support to family farmers is essential to our survival. Plus, providing enhanced payments to enrolled farm acres increases grain production and market prices. This is accomplished by taking more acres out of grain production through offering this attractive CRP payment. Thereby, in turn, the amount of grain available in the marketplace shrinks as not as much is grown, resulting in grain prices increasing. Simple law of supply and demand. Furthermore, increasing farm acres in the CRP program reduces greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to global climate change. This is owing to CRP's acre requiring that native prairie plants be established. These plants capture carbon and then store carbon beneath the ground. As a result, everyone wins from this expansive conservation plan. Our next letter, titled In Response to UNI Must Change. I read the guest column by Glenn Gray in the Tuesday Gazette, and while I agree that the University of Northern Iowa must change, I think the change must be more fundamental for UNI to survive. I have 56 years of experience teaching college students at Oklahoma State University and the University of Iowa, and I believe every state should take undergraduate education more seriously, as big universities tend to put their emphasis on graduate education and research. And while both of these areas are very important, so is undergraduate education. Let's change UNI's mission from basically competing with Iowa and Iowa State and make it a quality undergraduate institution, and have it model a place like Grinnell College, a good private college. UNI can be a good public undergraduate college. Signed, Jerry Croft from Tiffin. Our next letter, titled Reason for County Namesake Change. After reading the article, Johnson County No Longer Named for Slave Owner, in the June 25th Gazette, I was compelled to do a Google search for the original namesake holder, Richard Mentor Johnson. And as until this issue originated a year ago, I had no idea who he was. The article mentioned that Johnson served as vice president and that, quote, he was a lifelong slave owner and a despicable person toward Black people and Native Americans, end quote. I found out that Richard Mentor Johnson was the ninth vice president, serving between 1837 to 1841, and that he was also a Democrat, which was not mentioned by the county supervisors. I recently read a book, Freedom on Trail, the first post-Civil War battle over civil rights and voter suppression, by Scott Ferris. The author documents that slave ownership, the writing of Jim Crow laws, the establishment of the Ku Klux Klan, and its brutality, and the voting rights restrictions for people of color in the 1860s was primarily associated with the Democratic Party, especially in the Southern Confederate States. I would agree that the new namesake, Lulu Merrill Johnson, is a good choice, even though it is a little awkward that she was born 70 years after Johnson County was founded. Is this merely righting a wrong, or is it a deflection of the Democrats' history of control people and toward people of color before and after the Civil War? Written by William Erickson from North Liberty. Our next letter, get vaccinated, hashtag we can do this. Getting vaccinated is the most important thing you can do to help protect yourself and the loved ones from COVID-19. COVID-19 vaccines were made to save lives. They are safe and effective, and they help your body develop immunity to the virus. Additionally, COVID-19 vaccine cannot give you COVID-19 because they do not contain the live virus that causes the illness. The vaccines prevent nearly 100% of hospitalizations and deaths due to COVID-19. And now everyone aged 12 and older in the United States is eligible to be vaccinated for free, regardless of citizenship status. In fact, over 170 million people in the United States have received at least one dose of the vaccine to date. To find a vaccination provided or provider near you, go to vaccines.org, text your zip code to 438829 on your mobile service, or call 1-800-232-0233. If you have been vaccinated, encourage others to do so. Learn about how to talk to your friends and family about getting vaccinated at wecandothis.hhs.gov. Every person who chooses to get vaccinated brings us all a step closer to moving past the pandemic. Thank you for playing your part. Hashtag we can do this. And with that, we'll move on over to our obituary section. Donald Don Dean Fisk. Donald Fisk, 84, of Canal Fulton, Ohio, entered peacefully into heaven on Tuesday, June 29th, surrounded by his loving family. Don was born in Iowa City on February 8, 1937. He loved spending time with family, traveling, snow skiing, boating, camping, and was a man of many talents. Don had a passion for helping and teaching people and was an advocate for animal rescue. He retired from Hoover Company after many years of service. In lieu of flowers, Don would like donations to be made to the animal rescue of your choice. He was an advocate for spay and neuter. Friends and family will come to call from 4 to 5 p.m. on July 9th at Church of the Lakes in Canton, Ohio. A celebration of life will follow at 5 p.m. The service will be live streamed by clicking the link at churchofthelakes.org. Next, Mr. Jack Fisk. Jack Fisk, 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed Saturday, January 2nd, at Northbrook Manor Care Center in Cedar Rapids, following a short illness. A celebration of life service, noon Saturday, July 10th, at Burroughs Chapel and the Epicenter in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest, where full military rites will be conducted. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service Saturday at Brush Chapel. Private family interment will be in Linwood Cemetery. Next, we have Ms. Marlene Berg Gearhart. Marlene Berg Gearhart, 84, passed away at home in Camdenton, Missouri, surrounded by family on June 29th. She was born to Clarence and Olga Berg on February 10, 1937, in Decorah, Iowa. Marlene was baptized and confirmed at Decorah Lutheran Church. She was raised in Decorah and received her high school education from Decorah High. Marlene was married in 1954 to Charles Waddell, Jr., where they had a son. She later was divorced and was remarried to Lee J. Gearhart of Cedar Rapids. Marlene worked different part-time jobs, but was primarily a homemaker to her children, raising her family, living in Cedar Hills by Cherry Hill Park. They had three children. Marlene was a very creative and selfless person who was compassionate, went without for the sake of others, had a funny yet honorary side, and you always knew where you stood with her. Marlene was a believer in Christ following her Lutheran faith, a giver, loved sweets, especially chocolate, and maple candy, contributed regularly to charities of the St. Jude's Hospital, Boys Town, and especially the disabled veterans. She would prepare, then send care packages and handwritten Christmas cards and notes to veterans every year. Marlene was heavily involved in the PTA at Truman Elementary for several years until she became PTA president, involved with their children's activities and many other events. She would stand in the yard or front porch of her house hollering for her kids to come home for lunch or dinner, as they often were just up the street playing or next door in the park. She loved ice skating, sewing, cooking, baking, coloring, crafts, and decorating. Marlene crafted and made herself outfits for Lee sales, award trips taken to Acapulco, Jamaica, and the Bahamas. She was in the bowling league at May City Lanes for several years before getting her children involved bowling on Saturday mornings. In lieu of flowers, memorials or cards can be given at the celebration of life party or should be mailed to the care of Timothy Gearhart at 94 Highland Glen Court in Camden, Missouri, for her headstone marker. A special thank you to the staff and pastor and nurses of campus and home hospice care of Osage Beach, Missouri. Their care and support for Marlene and the family was heartfelt. Another special thank you to her beloved nieces, Kathy, Janine, and Vicky, for their love. In conclusion, in support of Marlene throughout the years, as they were truly cherished by her. At last, thank you to Justin, grandson-in-law, for his unwavering love and care. Marlene's wishes were to be cremated, not to have a traditional funeral service, but rather have a celebration of life party for family and friends. A celebration of life party will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on July 9th, which is next Friday, at Long Branch in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So please join us, as her wish was to have you there. Marlene's cremains will be brought home for burial and will be held at the Decorah Lutheran Cemetery in Decorah at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, July 10th, for those that wish to attend a graveside service where she will be laid to eternal rest. Next, Mr. Robert Mischek. Robert W. Mischek, 82, passed May 10th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City from injuries sustained in a fire at his Northeast Cedar Rapids apartment. Robert was born in Iowa and adopted by Hans and Margaret Stenick Mischek as a baby. He was the oldest of siblings, and first wife Shirley were married in Cedar Rapids. They were later divorced. Three daughters came from that relationship. Bob moved back to Cedar Rapids, and Ruth's son Rich assisted him and was with him after the fire that hospitalized and took his life. No information of services is currently listed. Next, Prudence Lynn Johnston. Prudence Lynn Johnston, 46, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on June 29th at home. A celebration of life will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. on Saturday, July 10th at Cedar Memorial, with private eulogies gravesides to follow. Prudence was born to Rebecca Pence and Paul Wells on August 4th, 1974, in Iowa City. After graduating from Jefferson High School, she married Paul Chronicle, and in 93, their son Seth was born. She trained at the Capri College and had a short career as a stylist before devoting herself to her home and family full-time. Prudence married Jeffrey Johnson on August 11th in Cedar Rapids, and their son Ian was born in 2001. Prudence had a rare warmth and vibrancy that attracted many friends throughout her life. She lit up any room she walked into, greeted loved ones and strangers alike with a radiant smile and heart. She was unfailingly generous, opening her home and arms to whoever needed a place to rest and an ear to listen. She spent her life taking care of others, beginning with her little sister Lisa, who, like so many others who love Prudence, admired her and depended on her candor and wisdom. Prudence loved her sons fiercely and devoted herself to them with singular focus. She loved music, connecting with friends, and cheering on her Hawkeyes. She had an innate artistic sensibility that found various forms throughout her life, including dance, drawing, and in her final years, creative writing. She was deeply loved by her parents, siblings, and friends, and her boys, and cherished above all others. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the families, nonprofit, The Choices Network, at thechoicesnetwork.org. Next, Anne Elizabeth Folkman. Anne Folkman, 57, left this earthly life to be with her Lord and Savior on June 11th, following an extended illness. A celebration of Anne's life will be held from 2 to 7 p.m. Saturday, September 4th, at Newall's Main Park Pavilion in Newall. A private family interment will be held at Keystone Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to Sarah and Ben Williams of Newall. Anne was brought up into Don and Carol Welb's family on September 10, 1963. Following graduation from St. John's High School in Bancroft in 1982, Anne attended the University of Northern Iowa, where she earned her Bachelor's of Social Work in 1986. Anne started her career in social work in Decatur, Illinois, and soon thereafter moved to Lorenz. She was united in marriage to Don Folkman on April 16, 1988. Anne continued her path of social work at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids in May of 94, then welcomed their daughter Sarah into the world. God led Anne to Amity Hospice, now Compassus, where she worked as a social worker for many years. Anne had a God-given empathetic heart and took great pride in her job and the opportunity to serve others. Anne cherished the many lifelong friends she gained throughout the years. Anne had a great appreciation for the earth and spent much time planting and tending her giant gardens full of vegetables, her perennials, and trees. She had an eye for unique items she would find in nature, especially rocks. Anne enjoyed traveling, hiking, reading, music, and cooking, and was an avid Iowa Hawkeyes fan. She loved most was spending time with her daughter, Sarah, and her son-in-law, Ben. Anne forever will be remembered for her vibrant smile, joyous giggle, contagious energy, adventurous spirit, compassionate and forgiving soul, and a great love of Jesus. Next, we'll move on to Mr. Robert Bob Lee Guter. Robert Guter, 89, of Cedar Rapids, passed on Thursday, July 1st, surrounded by his loved ones and by his loving daughter at West Ridge Care Center. Bob was born in Gutenberg on May 9, 1932, to George and Roma Guter. He attended the Gutenberg Public Schools and graduated with a bachelor's degree in English and speech from Iowa State Teachers College and a master's degree from University of Denver. While attending college, Bob was a member of Alpha Chi Epsilon Fraternity, Theta Alpha Phi National Honorary Dramatics Fraternity, and Kappa Delta Phi National Honorary Education Fraternity. Bob and Alo Benkin were married August 23, 1953. Bob went for Army basic training at Fort Leonard Wood and later was stationed at Fort Bragg in Fayette, North Carolina. He and Alo lived there until Bob was sent to Germany to serve in peacetime and Alo returned to Gutenberg. When Bob returned to the United States in 1955, they settled in Nashua, where Bob taught and was director of theater for 4 years. They moved to Cedar Rapids in 1959, where Bob taught and was the director of theater at Jefferson High School for 36 years. Bob was a co-founder of Jefferson Show Choir, West Side Delegation in 1968. He enjoyed volunteering at Bruce Moore, teaching English at Catherine McCullough Center, and was an active member of Our Savior's Lutheran Church for 61 years, taught at Coe College, directed plays for Theater Cedar Rapids, JC's, St. Luke's Auxiliary, in Oyster Regent Theater of Cedar Falls, and wrote and directed The Follies for 29 years. Bob's service recognition and awards include many. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday at Our Savior's Lutheran Church, where friends may visit with the family from 9 a.m. until service time. Pastor Phil Jurgensen will officiate. The service will include a celebration of Alo's life. Due to the potential for a high attendance, masks and social distance are encouraged. The family would like to thank the staff of West Ridge Care Center and Mercy Hospice for their compassionate care these past months. We are thankful so many of Bob's family and friends, colleagues, and former students were able to visit him and share their love. Memorials may be made to Robert Guter Thespian Scholarship at the Cedar Rapids Community Schools Foundation, Our Savior's Lutheran Church, and Bruce Moore. Next, Tim Conley. Tim Conley, 72, of Marion, passed away from a sudden illness on July 1st at the University Hospital in Iowa City. He was surrounded by his loving family and is survived by his wife, Sharon, and his daughter, Katie. Tim was born February 14, 1949, at La Crosse, Wisconsin. He graduated from the Monticello Community Schools in 1969. He went on to serve in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. Tim worked at Iowa Men's Reformatory before taking a job with the United States Postal Service in 1990. He retired from the Cedar Rapids Post Office in 2015. In retirement, Tim was employed at the Marion Hy-Vee. Tim and Sharon Wilms were married May 15, 1992. They loved watching Iowa sporting events, including the Packers and Cubs, spending time with family and friends. He was one of the biggest Green Bay Packers fans. Tim enjoyed the outdoors. He loved fishing and hunting on the river with his brothers. The harsh Iowa weather never deterred him from being outside. Tim took great joy in his family and was very proud of his daughter, Katie. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, July 6th at the St. John Lutheran Church, rural Monticello, with interment at Oakwood Cemetery. Friends may call after 11 a.m. Tuesday at the church. Pastor Caleb Shui will officiate at the services. If you are not fully vaccinated, masks must be worn and fitted properly over the nose and mouth at all times to enter the church. Social distancing standards need to be observed. Next, Ms. Marta Donna Hopper. Marta Hopper, 69, of Marion, formerly of Lincoln, Nebraska, passed away on Thursday, July 1st at her home. Per her wishes, cremation has taken place. There will be no services held at this time. A celebration of Donna's life is being planned for a later date. Donna was born August 27, 1951 in Germany, the daughter of Jan and Marta Turowitz. She graduated class of 1969 from Lincoln High School in Lincoln, Nebraska, and went on to attend beauty school in Illinois. On January 16th, she was united in marriage to Jan M. Harper in Lincoln, Nebraska. Donna worked for Square D, now Schneider Electric in Lincoln. Upon moving to Iowa, Donna attended and received her medical assistant certificate from Kirkwood Community College. She went on to work for Dermatology Clinic of Iowa for Dr. Knudsen, M.D., and Dr. Johnston, M.D. She enjoyed bowling league, sailing, traveling, reading, cooking, watching old movies, and playing computer games and card games. She especially loved being with her family, spending time with her grandchildren. Donna will be greatly missed by all who knew her and loved her. Next, we have Miss Eve Hodge. Eve Hodge, 80, of Marion, passed away on Saturday, June 26th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held at 4 p.m. Saturday, July 10th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, where the family will meet and greet friends and family from 2 to 4 prior to the service on Saturday. In agreement with her wishes, cremation will follow services. A private committal service will take place at a later date. Eve was born January 31, 1941, in Paxton, Illinois, the daughter of William and Ruby Lechenmeyer. She was a 1959 graduate of Gibson City High School, where she enjoyed archery, skating, and was a member of the marching band and FHA. Eve received a certificate from the Electric Radio Television Institute in Omaha. On August 29, 1965, she was united in marriage to Ralph F. Hodge in Normal, Illinois. She went on to work for nearly 20 years at the Steel Products in Cedar Rapids and Marion. Eve enjoyed knitting, water skiing, and was an avid reader. She loved being with her family and would be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Next, Ms. Carol Tharp. Carol Tharp, 80, of Marion, passed away peacefully on June 30th at St. Luke's Hospital, surrounded by her family. Visitation will be held on Monday, July 5th, at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids, starting at 10 a.m. until the time of the service at 11 a.m. Pastor Phil Jerkinson will officiate. An interment will follow at Cedar's Memorial Garden of External Love. Carol was born to Arthur and Florence Miller Sovereign on December 17, 1940, in Keystone. She moved to Cedar Rapids after graduating from high school to work at the telephone company. She soon met and married her husband, Jerry Gerald, and they married on September 20th, 1959. Carol loved to shop and decorate. She had a very special knack of putting, quote unquote, her touch on a room. When she left, you always knew she had been there. One of her favorite things to do was to go out to eat, and she enjoyed every moment spent with her family. She has been an active member of Our Savior's Lutheran Church for 53 years, where she participated in lay ministry and most recently the fellowship ministry. The family would like to thank Dr. Beard and the staff of St. Luke's for their overwhelming compassion while Mom was in your care. You are truly the best. Love, Mom. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family or Our Savior's Lutheran Church. Next, Ms. Joanne Dinkin. Joanne Petrick Dinkin was born January 11, 1924, in Ely to Rudolph and Libby Lineka. She moved to Bertram at the age of 3 and grew up attending Bertram Country School. During her high school years, she lived in Cedar Rapids while simultaneously working to support herself as a live-in maid. At 17, she graduated from McKinley High School. After graduating, Joanne attended Iowa State Teachers College in Cedar Falls and then taught country school for a year in Bertram. She married George Petrick in 1943. They would go on to have 4 beloved children. While raising the children, Joanne worked in her mother-in-law's Jeannie's store, grocery store, until it closed in 1958. In 1959, George and Joanne opened the Petrick Implement Company. She served as matron in the Order of the Eastern Star alongside George as a patron. Together, they were elected co-presidents of the Mount Vernon Music Association between 1976 and 1978. In 1980, George would join the Iowa House of Representatives, with Joanne serving as a secretary from 81 until he passed in 82. Known for her generosity, kindness, and kulaks, she was devoted mother of 4, grandmother of 8, and great-grandmother of 11. She passed away on April 26th at the age of 97, but her joyous spirit will live on in all who knew and loved her. There will be a memorial service at 10 a.m. Friday, July 9th, at the Presbyterian Church in Mount Vernon. And that will bring us to the end of today's reading for the Cedar Rapids Gazette on Sunday, July 4th. I've been your reader, Gloria DeFoley. I hope you have a great and wonderful Independence Day, and thank you for listening to your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.